to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host for today, Gail Seiler. Coming up on the show, we'll have an interview with Nate Bolton, a candidate for governor in the Democratic primary. This will be the first in a series of interviews of gubernatorial candidates that Local Talk will be airing over the next 2 weeks. Bronwyn Beattie Hansen, a member of the Ames City Council, will be here for her monthly segment. And in the last part of the show, we'll hear about the Democratic Forum for the 4th Congressional District, which was held recently at ISU. This is the seat that Representative Steve King currently holds. Well, it seems like spring is finally here, although, to be honest, it felt almost like summer over the weekend with temperatures near 80 degrees. And things have certainly greened up with the May showers, or should I say May deluges, that hit us over the past week. Although it brought hail and damage to some people's cars, the rain and sun really got things growing. And over the weekend, people were out working in their yards and swarming to local stores and nurseries to buy new plants and other materials to spruce up their outdoor areas. Looking ahead, the upcoming week looks to be pretty nice weather. High temperatures will be mostly in the 70s, at least until Friday. Today will be a repeat of the weekend, with lots of sunshine and near 80 degrees. Tuesday and Wednesday, it will be in the low 70s with a small chance of showers. And then by Friday, it will be a little cooler with a high of only 66 degrees. On the weekend, it looks like our nice weather will change a bit. The high both days will be 61, and there will be rain on both Saturday and Sunday. So that is how things look for this week's forecast in Central Iowa. And now here's a rundown of news across Iowa and Iowa in the national news. The Iowa legislative session finally came to a close on Saturday. It lasted 118 days, 18 days longer than anticipated. On Friday, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signed the so-called Fetal Heartbeat Bill, making it the most restrictive abortion law in the country. The law requires doctors to give prospective abortion clients an ultrasound test, and if a heartbeat is detected, doctors will be forbidden by law to perform an abortion. A fetal heartbeat usually occurs at about 6 weeks of pregnancy. The law makes exceptions in cases of rape and incest if the woman reports the incident within a set time frame, or if the doctor determines there is a medical emergency. Currently in Iowa, 20 weeks is the window permissible for an abortion, which is already more restrictive than some states. The new law is seen as essentially a ban on abortion because it is generally understood that most women don't even realize they're pregnant until after 6 weeks. No Democrats voted for the bill in the Iowa House or Senate. 6 Republican members of the House voted against it, including Chip Baltimore of Boone. The law is scheduled to go into effect July 1st of this year, although its implementation may be held up by the courts. On Friday morning, before Governor Reynolds signed the bill into law, Planned Parenthood of the Heartland organized a rally at the Iowa Capitol. Both Planned Parenthood of the Heartland and the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa announced that they would begin a lawsuit to fight the bill. Planned Parenthood of the Heartland tweeted, "We will fight like hell with everything we have." And the ACLU tweeted, "Iowans can rest assured ACLU won't let politicians get away with trying to block access to abortion." After the rally, a crowd filed into the reception area of the governor's office, read a pronouncement asking her not to sign the bill, and depositing coat hangers on the floor. Many see the law as a first step by anti-abortion advocates towards challenging and reversing Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court ruling that upholds a woman's right to abortion under the 14th Amendment. As the Iowa legislature ended its session, they also passed changes to Iowa's tax system that will reduce personal income taxes and phase in some cuts to corporate taxes. According to the Iowa Department of Revenue, high-income Iowans should see substantial savings, although most taxpayers will see lower income taxes. The income tax cuts are expected to cost the state around $362 million over the next 2 years, and more than $2.1 billion by 2024 if economic conditions are met. The University of Iowa announced last week that it will close its nearly 70-year-old Institute of Public Affairs. Since 1949, the Institute has served as a nonprofit resource at the University of Iowa College of Law. Its purpose is to assist with government operations at the state, county, and city level, and to help municipalities and agencies problem solve. The Institute connected the university with policymakers. More than 350 cities, counties, and regional agencies participated in Institute-run programs that reached more than 1,000 government officials and leaders, according to the Institute's most recent report. The University of Iowa stated that the closure was in response to decades of state cuts to public higher education. Last month, the university warned that it would cut back or eliminate campus-based centers or institutes that serve the state, region, or nation. This was in response to a $5.5 million take-back in state funding for the current budget year, done just 90 days before the budget year ends June 30th. They identified this as a long-term pattern in defunding Iowa universities. And U.S. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi traveled to Des Moines on Sunday to campaign for Iowa Democrats in anticipation of the June primary elections. She criticized the last session of the Iowa legislature for making extreme legislation. Iowa Republicans sent out multiple tweets calling Pelosi, quote, an elite liberal, end quote, and attempting to accuse Iowa Democratic congressional candidates of the same through association with Pelosi. And that's Iowa News and Iowa in the National News for the past week. Iowa's statewide primary election will take place on June 5th. The number of candidates for governor has thinned a bit, but the field is still crowded. Recently, KHOI correspondent Cal Halliburton sat down with each of the candidates for a conversation. Starting today and continuing over the next 2 weeks, KHOI will be bringing our listeners in-depth interviews with each of the Democratic and Libertarian candidates trying to unseat Governor Kim Reynolds.
It's our pleasure today to be talking with State Senator Nate Bolton. Senator Bolton is running in the primary election to be held June 5th for the Democratic Party nomination as a candidate for governor of Iowa. Senator Bolton grew up in Columbus Junction, Iowa, and graduated from Columbus Community High School. He holds a bachelor's degree from Simpson College, a master's degree in public administration from Drake, and a Juris Doctorate from Drake University Law School. Senator Bolton is a partner in the law firm of Hedberg & Bolton. He practices in workers' compensation, personal injury, and labor law. State Senator Bolton was elected to his first term in 2016 to represent the people of Senate District 16 on the northeast side of Des Moines and in Pleasant Hill. He is ranking member of the Iowa Senate Labor and Business Relations Committee and serves on the Appropriations, Commerce, and Judiciary Committees. Bolton's a runner and has completed 37 marathons. He and his wife, Andrea, live in East Des Moines. Senator Bolton, would you tell our listeners something about yourself that they'll not find on your website or with a search engine?
Well, the first thing is that there have actually been two more marathons since that site was updated, so it's 39 marathons now. So we're still out there running, literally, and in this race for governor. So that's one thing. The other thing that you probably won't find too easily on my bio is that I'm a curler. So I was very excited to see the U.S. Olympic team win a gold medal in curling. I started curling in college and have been doing it ever since.
As you talk to the people across the state, what are their most frequent concerns?
You know, it is interesting because as you travel the state, you obviously give your stump speech a lot and then take questions. And there are certain topics that if I leave it out of the stump speech, just for whatever reason, it just doesn't fit the audience or whatever, that will always come up even if I don't mention it. And if I don't talk about education, I'll get a question on education. If I don't talk about healthcare and privatized Medicaid, I will get a question on healthcare or privatized Medicaid. If we don't talk about the budget, we'll get a question about the budget. I think those three things really do pop up more often than not. And then a fourth thing that I think is probably the most frequent is water quality and our environmental priorities. So I think from those four, that's the most I hear from voters about.
Let's assume that you're elected then. Which would be your top priorities and what specific actions would you take to implement them?
Sure. Well, the one topic that I didn't mention those four that I always talk about is the workers' rights perspective. It's kind of defined me as an attorney for 12 years and is something that obviously last year, as the ranking Democrat on the Labor Committee, we took on some very tough issues that held back and took away from a lot of Iowans and their quality of life. And I think we have to get back to valuing our workforce in this state. And I think that in part addresses a lot of those other concerns as well. We want to have a quality education system that allows skilled workers to succeed when they get out in the workforce. We want to have the ability to make sure that every Iowan has access to a quality health system in this state. And we want to make sure that we do everything we can to grow wages and restore rights in the workplace so people feel like they can have the quality of life that they ought to.
Trying the specific actions again, then, let's say on the collective bargaining issue, would you simply negate what was done the last couple of years and go back to the structure that was in place before, or would you change that structure somewhat when you do step back?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the specific action question because I think that is something that separates the field a little bit. I'm someone who believes in specific action, and I've taken specific action in the legislature. I've introduced a Senate file, a bill that I introduced earlier this year on not only restoring lost collective bargaining rights for those answering the sacred call of public service, but getting the conversation back to where it should have been, which is expanding the scope of those bargaining rights. So firefighters can talk about protective equipment. So corrections officers can talk about staffing ratios. So teachers can talk about, child teacher ratios in elementary school settings. So all those things are important and should have been where the focus was on labor rights to begin with.
You mentioned water quality. We've got more than 8,000 confined animal feeding operations in the state. With those comes an enormous amount of waste product.
Right.
And we apply that to the land. What can you do about that?
So on the issue of water quality, I think we look at what Kim Reynolds was talking about in her first condition of the state address as governor. She promised a monumental water quality bill to Iowans. What we didn't see was a monumental water quality bill. What she ended up doing was pushing through a bill that wasn't her idea, wasn't her initiative. It was the bill that the Senate had already passed last session and the House had not taken up because it doesn't do enough for water quality. So we got the leftovers from the prior session and no leadership on this issue. I'm someone, as you talk about specific action points, I introduced a bill that would have funded the Water and Land Legacy Trust Fund, something voters asked us to do in 2010 with over 60% of voters supporting it. Polls show it's now up to 70% popularity. I got several senators from the Democratic side of the aisle to co-sponsor it with me, as well as our one independent senator in the Iowa Senate to sign on for that. So we had even bipartisan support. We just missed tripartisan support to get it done, but we're going to keep pushing on that because voters want to see action on this, not just talking points.
There are so many other issues as well at confronting the state now. What are we going to do about mental health services?
The single biggest threat to mental health services right now is not the mental health system itself. It's privatized Medicaid because we have a lot of providers out there that have been very upfront and said, if we don't get a change in this system and see fewer and fewer denials and delays and reimbursements, they're going to have to start scaling back services. When they scale back services, that doesn't just affect Medicaid recipients. That affects the whole healthcare system. So we have substance abuse centers. We have mental health providers that are not getting the payments they need to just maintain the services they're providing now. And again, going back to Governor Reynolds, you're not going to solve problems that you don't believe exist. We had a mental health forum that the Des Moines Register hosted with candidates from every party participating except for one. Governor Reynolds did not attend that forum and submitted a two-minute video bragging about the condition of our mental health system. You're not going to solve problems you don't believe exist. While we've taken some steps in the right direction, particularly in acute care and a bill that addressed preventing suicide of students with training and awareness in our school system, we have a long way to go to making it a real budget priority and getting us out of this privatized Medicaid mess that is threatening healthcare services across the board.
One thing you might be able to do is by executive order change that privatized system?
Correct. I mean, that's one of the – Kim Reynolds had a golden opportunity. When she gave her first address as governor, she could have said, I'm different from Terry Branstad. This was a go-it-alone plan that Governor Branstad enacted. We're going to get out of this. Instead, she waited a year to admit in her condition of the state address that mistakes were made in privatization, but then offered no real solutions. And in terms of mental health, I didn't start talking about these issues when I became a state senator. I was out there on the front line of this when this administration closed down two of our state's four mental health facilities and did nothing to replace the lost services. I took a case all the way to the Supreme Court and argued in front of the Supreme Court to reopen those facilities that had been shut down. And then as a senator, I introduced a bill that would have forced reopening them that, again, if it was taken up, would have provided real services to the most severe cases of mental illness in our state that were instead left to nursing homes and other providers. I talked to a man from Clarinda whose brother was in the Clarinda facility at the time it was shut down. Within 3 weeks of that shutdown, his brother was dead because the only thing they could do was take him to a nursing home. That's no replacement for 24/7 supervised mental health care.
Let's try another one and shift gears a little bit. You mentioned education as one of the top things that you needed to deal with. Is there a specific action you can take with that?
Yeah. Well, going back to one of your first questions, which was something people may not know about me, I actually went to Simpson College to be a high school government and history teacher. Student taught at Indianola High School and did some substitute teaching during law school back in Wapello High School, where I kind of the area where I grew up. So obviously public education is a big concern for me. When we go 8 years of underfunding our schools against the rate of inflation, and then after all that effective cuts, we have this Republican legislature introducing school vouchers, the effect of running away from our public schools, we have a serious problem there. But I think aside from just funding our schools appropriately and getting us out of this idea that we have to switch over to vouchers for the education future of Iowa, we also have to talk about those 22-year-olds we're needing to choose to go into rural Iowa school districts to start their careers. That public sector bargaining bill that they pushed last year through the legislature with lightning speed, with immediate effect, just told every teacher in this state they'll never see a wage increase that keeps up with inflation. They will never have an adequate voice in their health insurance and other benefits, so they're going to see effective wage cuts going forward. They're not going to get funded in the classroom from supplemental state aid, so they're going to put more of their own resources into that classroom. And mid-year budget cuts and this year's end-of-the-year budget cuts to Iowa and Iowa State are going to affect tuition. So you're going to have a higher and higher student debt load as you start that career. And then you layer in the last piece of the puzzle, they're threatening the security of IPERS. If we lose IPERS as a benefit for retaining quality teachers, we're going to need a lot of those 22-year-olds choosing to go into the profession of teaching with the knowledge that they're not going to keep up with competitive wages. So that's a crisis that's coming, and I think we need to change that public sector bargaining statute to get there and get back to funding education as a real priority. No state has ever made its future stronger by compromising on the education of its children.
One of your opponents seeking the nomination seems to have a big effort placed on the minimum wage. Do you have a position on that?
Yeah. Well, last year, one of the things that I did as a senator was I tried to introduce a minimum wage bill that would have prevented minimum wage earners in five Iowa counties from seeing their wages cut. because that's what this legislature did last year. It reached into five Iowa counties that actually stood up for our lowest wage earners and reduced the minimum wage. Remember, when Branstad and Reynolds were first campaigning, their promise was they were going to increase the wages of Iowans by 25%. Yet when they had the opportunity to do something about that, they did the exact opposite, reached into five Iowa counties and reduced wages. I introduced a bill that would have taken the Polk County wages statewide to prevent anyone from seeing a minimum wage cut and actually raise the minimum wages in the other counties, that in the 94 other counties that needed to see that. I'd like to see us get to $15 an hour. My plan would be to do it by 2024 and then index it to inflation so we don't have this conversation over and over again where we wait a decade to catch the minimum wage earners up to what should have been the wage in the first place, and then also put small businesses in a position where they're seeing a rapid increase in wages that they have to deal with. If we do it the right way, it's responsibly and adjust with inflation so workers aren't losing out on their cost of living.
That brings up another issue, and that's the money in elections.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how much or if we can do something to restrict the amount of money that gets into campaigns, particularly from out-of-state sources.
Well, getting back to your point of actions over rhetoric, I've introduced an amendment this session on a bill dealing with campaign finance, trying to just apply the federal limits to Iowa politics, trying to limit the massive contributions that could be dumped into a campaign for governor or a state senate or a state house race. Unfortunately, Republicans used a procedural move to make that not germane to a bill that dealt directly with campaign finance. So we've got an uphill battle, but it is a discussion that must be had because a lot of other states are way ahead of Iowa in terms of campaign finance and transparency in the process.
We've been talking with State Senator Nate Bolton, who's running in the primary election to be held June 5th for the Democratic Party nomination as a candidate for governor of Iowa. Thank you again, Senator Bolton.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
That was the first in a series of interviews with candidates for governor done by KHOI reporter Cal Halliburton. Interviews with other candidates will air on each local talk show over the next 2 weeks, so remember to tune in for those. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you are listening to Local Talk. And we are now turning to more local politics. We've been joined by Bronwyn Beattie Hansen, a member of the Ames City Council. Thanks for being here.
Oh, hi. Thank you.
Good morning on this lovely morning.
It is beautiful.
So there are some recent council actions that I would like to ask you about. Recently, City Council passed a rental concentration cap for certain neighborhoods in Ames. Can you explain what that ordinance is and what it will do?
Yes. So this week we have our second reading of this ordinance. And essentially what it does is it limits the amount of rental permits that we would issue in several neighborhoods. And so the neighborhoods that this applies to would include Scan and Colonial Village, the Old Ames Middle School, College Creek neighborhood, Oak to Riverside, and then Oakwood Forest and Old Edwards, so that handful of what we call near-campus neighborhoods.
Okay.
So the idea is we would limit rental permits to 25% of the properties in those areas, and many of those areas are actually already at or above that 25%. So what it looks like, in effect, especially in neighborhoods that are already over that 25% cap, is that no new rental permits can be issued, basically. And this has taken a lot of council's time lately, actually, just the whole rental discussion in general, both our rental residency limits or occupancy limits and then this cap issue. We've been talking about it for a number of months now, and it's...
And there's been a lot of public input.
Mm-hmm. The rental cap issue has been the issue I have received the most input on my time on council, hands down, easily.
Mm-hmm.
On both sides of the issue, people feel very strongly about it. So on the pro side, you know, the reason we undertook this and the argument for it would be that you have neighborhoods where you've seen an increase in the number of rentals that they've had over the last 10, 15 years especially. And they're concerned in those neighborhoods that if we don't stem the tide, it'll eventually, yeah, they'll all become rentals in those neighborhoods and will have lost the stability that makes a good neighborhood, for one thing. So, you know, people knowing each other and talking with each other and interacting, that kind of stability and the strength of a neighborhood, there's a point at which rentals can start to make that go downhill. And again, I don't mean to speak poorly of renters, right? So it's not necessarily that renters are all bad or they're all, you know, that's not the issue. It's just about long-term residents and the investment in a home, the differences in those two factors when you have a lot of rentals versus, you know, permanent residents. And then also, from my point of view, too, I think, you know, we hear a lot about the lack of affordable housing in Ames. And a lot of the homes in these neighborhoods are were older, you know, they were maybe in the $120,000 to $180,000 range in terms of pricing. And to me, we really need to protect what we've got of that inventory of low price homes, because there's not much, and new homes that are being built are nowhere near that in terms of cost. They're way more. So, you know, I see that, you know, we want to watch that too and try to hold on to that inventory of houses for folks who want to live in Ames too. So that's the argument for. The argument against the rental cap would be that we are essentially limiting what someone can do with their home. So if someone has purchased a home in one of these areas, say they purchased it several years ago and they thought, oh, I'll live here for a few years and then I'll rent it, you know, and move somewhere else and use that rent to, you know, pay down my mortgage on another home purchase. You know, that's not an uncommon thing to do, especially in Ames. And this would limit folks from doing that. It also might limit the sales of homes if before, say, they were being prospected for rental homes, mm-hmm. now they can't do that anymore. And so we'll keep it. I mean, it'll be interesting to watch the home value and sales of the homes in those areas too. So those would be the arguments we've heard against the cap.
And was there kind of a division in who was on either side of this issue? For example, was it homeowners that were on one particular side and students who were on another side? Or how did it play out like that?
Good question. I would say we don't hear much from students as a group, which is too bad. I mean, they do make up half the population, and it would be I would love it if they were involved more and we heard more from them. We do have a student rep on the council, of course, and he definitely was, you know, bringing what student concerns would be to the table. I would say most of the pro has definitely been neighborhood, long-time residents. And then the folks who are opposed, you know, that's a combination of rental associations and some homeowners maybe who did plan to rent mm-hmm. their house, of course. Yeah, so you have some homeowners in that camp too. And then also the real estate industry. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And this pertains to just single houses, mm-hmm. yeah. not to apartment buildings.
Right. Yeah, of course. Yeah, it wouldn't work to limit rental permits on apartment buildings because they're designed as rental units, you know. So, yeah, this applies only to single family houses and duplexes, but those that are, yeah, that mm-hmm. it's the single-family house style, yeah.
And does the city have a plan or a vision in terms of the balance, well, the number of apartment buildings in the city and the balance between houses and apartment buildings? Because it just seems to many people that apartment buildings are just springing up like weeds around the city. Is there a plan?
Well, I mean, in our land use plan, we designate lands, you know, that would be appropriate for high density housing. We designate lands that would be appropriate for low density housing. So in a very broad sense, there's a plan for like what parts of town or what pieces of land are best used for low density versus high density. But no, a lot of times it's not necessarily within council's control to pursue building a new, you know, apartment building. And if
they
if,
don't have to get a permit or zoning or.
Well, they do, of course, have to get like building permits and things like that. But if the zoning's already right for them and they can get their building permit without special permissions or modifications, then we can't turn them down. If they want to build, if someone has a piece of land that's zoned for high density, and they come in and they want to build an apartment building on it, there's unless they want some sort of special permission, you know, that we would have the opportunity to approve or not.
So that's controlled by zoning, and that's already set, and that's not something that's being looked at.
Yeah, I mean, every once in a while, zoning gets changed to allow for, you know, we did have to allow special permissions for the development that's on the corner of Lincoln Way and, what is that one?
Dakota?
No, not that far. Where the gas station was, where the Chinese homestyle cooking was. I forget that cross street.
Oh, yeah. Man. State or?
No, a little bit farther to the east of
that. Yeah, I know.
Stanton,
I pass
maybe?
It all the time.
I want to say Stanton. Yeah. And so that one, they did come in and ask for some special incentives and permissions. And we did grant that one because, you know, if you're going to put a bunch of high-density student apartments somewhere – on the corner across from campus is probably the best place for, you know, a building like that rather than half a mile out, you know, three quarters of a mile out somewhere else. But in general, I know what you mean. There have been a lot of new apartments, and I think council is hearing that rents are starting to come down in apartments. And so I think in my thinking anyway, the homes in those campus town areas, there is somewhere for folks who, you know, students say who would rent those houses, there are a lot of options now for them that they didn't have before in terms of other places they can go. So I think it's a good time. It's a good time to have a lot of apartment inventory. But I think you're right in that we're not really anxious to see a lot more develop because of decreasing enrollment at Iowa State, or at least topping off of enrollment at Iowa State.
I was wondering about that. If the decrease in funding for ISU is obviously going to play out in a lot of different ways in the university, and how that will impact student enrollment, and whether there will be then a glut of apartments and rentals and so on, I guess remains to be seen. But something that should be considered, I guess.
Definitely. Yep, definitely something to watch. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so another change that I've been hearing about is changes in parking meter fees.
Yeah, that is true. We did increase parking meter fees, or that will increase here at the beginning of the fiscal year. That was done in mostly because of upcoming maintenance and things we see in terms of needs for maintaining city lots and other parking infrastructure for the city. It costs a lot of money to upkeep and maintain that. And the parking meter fund has been sufficient so far, but it's...
So that's what that revenue goes to.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, parking meter fees and then also fines go towards maintenance of the parking system. And our parking meter rates had been, I would consider them sort of low, you know, in the quarter for an hour range. And so they will be increasing both in campus town and downtown. And then there will be some changes to the system as well. We will start to modify the parking meters so they can take credit cards and app-based payment methods too over time.
So what will the fees increase to? Do you have those specific?
I should have written that down to bring with me. I regret not doing that. But it's quite a bit, I would say, you know, maybe up to 75 cents for an hour.
So that was basically based on the need for new revenue.
Yeah. Yep. Over time. Yeah, exactly. And it's all future, you know. Yeah, the revenue we'll collect from that will pay for future improvements to parking infrastructure and repairs to lots and maintenance. You know, now that the city has new stormwater ordinances. And so when we redo a parking lot, we have to do a lot more than we used to have to. Things like that are upcoming.
And will there also be increases in water and sewer rates?
Yep.
Coming?
So that was also something we voted for in this last budget cycle. The reason for that, especially with sewer, we're looking at in a few years, the EPA has requirements for nutrient reduction, so nitrates and things like that that are in the water. And cities, since it's very hard to measure and regulate all the tiny little sources, aka like farms and things like that, it's going to fall mostly on the backs of cities to clean the waters, which it's interesting. I mean, cities are not the biggest polluters,
but they're the ones who will be responsible for ensuring that it's good water.
Exactly. We are going to have to pay a lot to clean the water. And so looking at that upcoming gigantic cost increase, we definitely had to do something about sewer rates to make sure we'll have funding to attempt to do that. So that's mostly what that came down to is sort of is looking to a future need for costs. So.
And related to then what's been done at the state level, or rather not been done at the state level to cover those kinds of costs.
Yes, exactly. Yep. And, you know, this council's talking about trying to do other things, too, you know, making sure we are investigating not only the treatment of water but also sort of preventative measures, you know, buffer strips along rivers where we can or things like that that can help stop the flow of chemicals into the water. But we're not sure yet whether the regulations will allow that kind of change, too, in addition to just measurements of the water quality.
And just one last thing. Ames has transitioned to a new mayor, John Hala. So as a city council member, do you see an impact yet of a new mayor?
Good question. I mean, I think I would say things have been going really, really well at council. The new mayor is doing a great job leading the meetings, setting fair parameters for folks who are speaking. And that, I think, you know, the guidance of the meetings is probably one of the more visible things that the mayor's office does, that and appearing at events and things like that, but really leading the meetings. And that has been growing, you know, like I said, going really well. And I feel like it's a good year for us. So
thanks for coming in today. We've been talking with city council person Bronwyn Beatty Hansen. And we're glad to have you come in and be on the hot seat and have you answer our questions about city council governance each month.
Oh, well, happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
And that, of course, was Dancing Queen by ABBA. And if you are an ABBA fan, and we know you're out there, that will whet your appetite for the new songs that the Swedish band will be releasing. This week, it was announced that the first new music from ABBA in 35 years will be released in the coming months. On April 26th, the three Democratic candidates for Iowa's 4th District, now represented by Steve King, faced off in a debate at Memorial Union, sponsored by the ISU College Democrats. The candidates are J.D. Scholten, a former baseball player with a large backing from progressives in Iowa, John Passion, a pediatrician from Ames, and Leanne Jacobson, a Spencer City Council person who has been active on various statewide boards. This Thursday, we will be airing the debate almost in its entirety on Heart of Iowa at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m., but we thought we'd give you a taste of it today. A couple hundred people were in attendance at the Memorial Union, including a large contingent of J.D. Shulton staffers wearing shirts and passing out stickers. The League of Women Voters was also on hand registering voters. Here is the outgoing president of the ISU Democrats describing the difficulties they foresee with the new voter ID law possibly discouraging the student vote.
The ISU College Democrats are extremely excited about being able to hear from our three great candidates and get to know them a bit more. We wanted to host this event to make sure that everyone is aware of, excited about, and participating in the June 5th primary election. It is especially important to us that we raise the profile of the primary election on campus specifically because, among many other problems, the new voting laws in effect for this election make it so that ISU will not be able to have an in-person satellite voting location on campus for our students. This is because of the arbitrary shortening of the absentee voting period from 40 days to 29 days. With 40 days of absentee voting, we would have been able to have a full week of voting on campus. The early voting period now begins on May 7th, and our classes end on May 4th. Despite this, we are encouraging ISU students to go the extra step and either vote by absentee ballot or vote in person on June 5th.
As I mentioned, we will be airing the debate almost in its entirety. We had to shorten the applause lines a bit on Thursday during Heart of Iowa. But one question that we had to cut in order to fit the debate into the 55-minute segment is a question on the topic of Syria and authorizing war.
After President Trump's recent strike on Syria, how do you view America's role in the Middle East? And if elected to Congress, under what conditions would you vote to authorize the use of force? This is going to be answered in the order of Leanne Jacobson, John Passion, and then J.D. Shulton.
I believe we need a comprehensive plan on our overall strategy, not only fighting terrorism around the world, but Syria in particular. And I believe it was Tim Kaine and a group of bipartisan legislators who have advocated for revisiting the automatic use of force. Authorization. I'm sorry, I had words running through my head. And that makes a lot of sense because that legislation was passed right after 9/11, and things have changed since then. And so we need, it makes sense to revisit it as security has changed, technology has changed, relationships with countries and regions have changed. So that makes sense to do that, and I absolutely think that we need to have Congress be able to authorize force before proceeding.
There's a pretty good chance that that's the hardest question we're going to get about what to do with Syria. It's a horrible situation that's going on right there, right now, and the Syrians are suffering. I don't really know the answer to when I would be in favor of intervention by forces. I do know, though, that we're not good at nation building. We've never been good at it. If we do go into Syria, we need to make sure we have a clear, clear goal and we stop at that goal. But right now, I would be in favor of really pushing for a strong diplomatic solution to stop the killing. I want the United Nations to be brought in. I don't want us to be the only one there. I think we can use our strength, especially our air strength, to kind of push the envelope and maybe make people come to the table. And I think that's how we need to handle it. But we do need to do something right now.
One of the roles of Congress is to hold the president accountable. And whether it's a Democrat or especially now with the circumstances that we have right now, that needs to be upheld. And I feel the president has had too much power for quite a while now. As far as Syria and just the Middle East in general, my senior year, I was done with my eligibility for baseball. And I was finishing up school, going to a bunch of tryouts. And I took one weekend off to travel from Lincoln, Nebraska, all the way to D.C. to protest the potential war in Iraq. And we got there 8 a.m., got on a bus at 6 p.m., went straight back. Not the most relaxing trip I've had to D.C. But that was in 2002, October 2002. And the war happened in March the following year, and we're still there. And we got to have some sort of a vision of what we're going to do in the Middle East and just in general, because we just can't keep on funding and funding and funding. And we have plenty of infrastructure ideas to do with that money, and plenty of other healthcare and all these other things that we can do with that money. So holding the president accountable, let's have a plan to just and execute that plan, like we've mentioned, with the Middle East. Thank you.
That was Leanne Jacobson speaking first, then John Passion, then J.D. Shulton. All three are Democratic candidates to represent Iowa's 4th District in U.S. Congress. They will compete in the June 5th primary, and the winner will face off against the Republican candidate, most likely incumbent Stephen King. Perhaps the most interesting question, according to our correspondent Greta Anderson, who taped the event, was the final question, which served as the closing statement. The question was, you all agree that we need to beat Steve King, but what issue would you refuse to compromise on, even if it means losing the election? The students certainly threw the candidates a curveball with that one, but after a moment or two, each came up with a strong answer. Here are the candidates, starting with J.D. Shulton, followed by John Passion and Leanne Jacobson.
I'm passionate about a lot of issues. I'm passionate about health care. I'm passionate about climate change. I'm passionate about the economy. I'm passionate about protecting our farmers. But all of that doesn't come into effect unless we take money out of politics. And if I'm going to go down, I'm going down swinging. That's my baseball motto. And what we need to turn back Citizen United, but that's just a start. We talk about in healthcare and these prices and how pharmaceutical companies are getting away with selling us a lot for a lot and then going to another country and selling it for a little. We need to find solutions for that. And it all boils down to taking money out of politics. Like I mentioned, I don't want to take guns away. I want to take the NRA's influence out of D.C. It all is part of the same thing. I happened to been very successful in my fundraising efforts. In fact, at the closing of this last quarter, we had $75,000 more than the people here on stage and King combined. And all of that is individual donations, with the exception of two campaigns that have contributed to us and an endorsement we have from the People's House Project, whose main goal is getting income diversity into D.C. And I like to say that the average person in Congress is 58 years old and net worth $1 million. Well, I'm 20 years younger and just shy of $1 million short of that mark. And basically, I can't be bought. And I'm going down swinging with that, and because this district deserves better. So thank you.
Me? Am I next? Okay. Okay, final statement. Again, I would like to really thank the College Democrats, the ISU College Democrats. This was a great, great forum that you set up. I'm impressed with the organization. I'm impressed with everything about it. I had a chance to talk with someone on the committee of lectures, and they said basically while they are part of this that you did it all. So you should give yourselves a hand. Thank you very much. There's a lot of things I'm not going to compromise on, but there are two issues that actually, I'll be quite honest, may lose the election for me in the 4th District, but I will not compromise on it. One is the border wall. There is no need for a Mexican border wall. The other thing I will not compromise in is my stand on common sense gun legislation, including an assault rifle ban. One of the things that I promised myself when I started this was I wouldn't change who I was. I actually have worn a tie more than I usually do during this campaign, but I don't commonly wear ties, so you're not going to see me with a lot of ties. I ride my bike a lot. I still ride my bike whenever I can. I'm going to be true to my principles. When you go into medical school, one of the things they have you do is write a personal statement. Okay? Why do you want to be a doctor? Why do you want to go to the University of Iowa? And they suggest that we keep those personal statements and take them out every 10 years and see if your principles that you had when you were 21 are the same principles that you hold today. Well, I took mine out not too long ago and I read it. And I'm kind of proud of myself. Two of the things that came out in my personal statement was I wanted to serve in underserved areas in the country and the world, and I do that. And I'm pretty proud that I kept to that. And I also got in my personal statement, I kept saying how I want to help people, I want to help people. Not too long ago, I'm going to go over, sorry. Not too long ago, someone came into my practice for their routine two-week checkup. And during that checkup, we found that there was something wrong with the child's eyes. We got them to an ophthalmologist right away, and by the next morning, they had thick cataracts removed from this child's eyes. The parents told me that the ophthalmologist in Iowa City kept saying that if the diagnosis was delayed by even 4 to 5 weeks, that the child would have been blind. And now this child will have full function of their eyes for their whole life. They said I did a great job, but I really didn't. I just practiced good medicine. But they were allowed to come in to see me. And if they didn't have insurance, there'd be a pretty good chance that they would have skipped that two-week visit. And we would have had someone who was blind, and they didn't need to be. My principles and my values, I'm a different man than I was at 21 years of age, but my principles and values are the same. My goal is to help, and I want to be your congressman. I want to go to Washington and help. Thank you.
I think the single issue I would never compromise on, and it's the basis of this election and the platform we're running on, is standing up for the people and the values of our small towns across this district. These are people that have been forgotten for the past 15 years. They have no leader. They are struggling and they are suffering. And I think that they are worth fighting for, and I will fight for people in this district. You know, we can talk about fundraising or operations, and, you know, certainly they're part of an election. But I believe the most important part of an election is the message. And we are running on a different message that has been and something that people in this district haven't heard of. And it's about connecting with people in small towns and rural communities and talking about the values we all share, because we share a lot of them. And I don't think anyone that I can think of has worked to hold Steve King accountable to the fact that he has done nothing to help Iowans, and he does nothing and he has got nothing done. And we can fall into traps about his craziest tweet or, you know, the other things, because they're easy to fall into, but those traps don't work. What does work is talking about people and people's lives and our neighbors who are working 2 to 3 jobs to get by, and the servers I have, and, you know, that I'm paying, you know, $12, $11 an hour plus tips. what they care about. They don't care about King's, you know, crazy tweet or, you know, his insult on our immigrant communities. What they care about is, do they have health care or not? And do they have a check that's going to be able to pay for their groceries? Those are the people that I will never compromise or forget. I will fight for them till the end, and I think that's how we're going to beat Steve King. And that's what I am going to be talking about every single day for this entire campaign. I am going to be talking about Iowans and small towns, small town people, small town values, and quality of life. And that is how I am going to beat Steve King, and that is how I'm going to make this campaign different. And I see I have 30 seconds, so I'm going to go on. I am, you know, throughout my career, the past 20 years in Iowa, every step of the way, everything I have done has been around lifting people up and bettering communities, from AT&T and, you know, pushing rural broadband 20 years ago to the Technology Association and getting kids involved in STEM careers so they could be part of the 21st, you know, century job market. With Endow Iowa and passing bipartisan legislation that has helped communities funnel $700 million in community foundations across our state that has helped communities become better. I am a city councilwoman. I am a small business owner. I have a very well-rounded background in state and local government. The only person up here who is an elected official, and I ran and won city council as the first Democrat, well, the first woman in 25 years and a Democrat to boot, in an area that voted 70% for Trump. So I think we've got a message. I think we've got we are on to something when we are looking out for people first. And I don't think anyone else on this stage, with all due respect, can say that they have this experience and that they can do this. And I am asking for your vote on June 5th. Thank you so much, and thank you for the extra 10 or 20 seconds.
Those were excerpts from a forum at ISU Memorial Union featuring three Democratic candidates for Congress. For more of that forum, tune in to Heart of Iowa this Thursday, 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards, and we also heard Dancing Queen by ABBA. Thanks to Bronwyn Beattie Hansen, to Greta Anderson, and to Cal Halliburton for their contributions to the show. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.